Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The police shooting death of 18-year-old Michael Brown on August 9th has turned the streets of Ferguson, Missouri, into something of a battleground, setting off more than a week's worth of unrest in the St. Louis suburb. The media has been part of the story. On NPR's Morning Edition, Washington Post reporter Wesley Lowery described what led to his arrest in a McDonald's in Ferguson.
And then as I turned to go to the door they were directing me, my backpack, which had only been hooked over one shoulder, started to slide off of my shoulder. I said, "Officers, I just need to adjust my backpack. Give me 1 second." And that's when they said, "All right, let's take them." And they threw me up against the soda machine, put plastic restraints on the backs of my hand, told me I was resisting arrest, and then eventually led me outside.
Coming up, we're going to hear from experts about how the police have responded to the protests there. Joining us now is St. Louis Public Radio reporter Jason Rosenbaum. Welcome to the show, Jason.
Thank you for having me.
What has your experience been covering the protests?
Well, I have primarily covered the protests during the day, and I've been telling a lot of people that it's it's a night and day difference of covering this story. You cover this story during the day, and you're mainly talking to very passionate but very friendly protesters who are not talking about violence or confrontations with police. They're talking about the matter of hand, and that is finding some sort of judicial process for the officer that shot Michael Brown. But for my colleagues that have been there at night, it's been, you know, running away from tear gas. It's been, you know, getting into these very scary situations where, you know, people's safety is kind of in question. And as you just kind of alluded to, there have been kind of this tension between journalists both nationally and locally who are covering the story and the law enforcement who are trying to handle a chaotic situation. So, you know, for me, it's been probably a lot different than some of my colleagues who have covered it at night. And I'm sure as this story goes on, I'm going to be tapped for night duty as well, and I'll probably find out for myself what others have been feeling.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest during this segment is Jason Rosenbaum. He's a reporter for the St. Louis Public Radio. We're talking about, of course, the unrest and violence in Ferguson, Missouri, after the shooting death by a police officer of 18-year-old Michael Brown. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, we just heard on NPR News that some of the problem has been criminal elements coming in from outside as far away as California to exploit the after dark unrest. What do you know about that?
Well, I think that the protesters are kind of divided into multiple segments. There's the aforementioned peaceful protesters that I call them are there and not trying to cause any trouble. There are people who have been in this situation throughout who I think are just upset with the restrictions that have been placed by both the local police and the state police.
As in the curfew? The curfew, for example.
Mm-hmm. And then I think there are these elements from out of state, you know, groups that are intentionally trying to cause trouble, as Captain Johnson mentioned. And I think that the people who are kind of leading this effort are trying to target those people, trying to get them identified, and just trying to either calm them down or just get them out of the situation altogether, because it just doesn't look good for this entire situation if the focus is on the people that are intentionally trying to cause trouble, when the people who I mentioned during the day, they want to focus on the matter at hand, and that's getting this situation resolved for Mike Brown and his family. And that's kind of a struggle right now.
Is the sense that the nighttime troublemakers are doing it to enable looting and that sort of a thing, or are they doing it to make a point, and their point is just more violent than the daytime protesters?
It's hard to say what their intentions are.
Okay.
You know, I think that in the beginning of this, if you just talked with people on the street, and not necessarily the people that were doing any of the looting or the violence,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that in the beginning, I think that might have been an unlawful but angry expression of anger against the situation. I think as this time has gone on, as I've just kind of mentioned, there just have kind of been people that have been coming here from all over the country, and at least I think a very small few are trying to take advantage. I must point out, though, I've talked to people who have come here from all over the country, from Atlanta, Chicago, the Metro East, surrounding area, and just places around St. Louis who are coming to Ferguson not because they want to start trouble, mm-hmm. but because they are moved by this situation and they feel like this is an important time for them to act and speak out. I can't emphasize that enough because while I think rightfully the violence and the confrontations is getting a lot of attention, as I mentioned before, mm-hmm. there is an element that is trying to make their point across too. Unfortunately for them, right now at least, at this moment, the kind of troublemakers are getting more attention than probably the peaceful protesters want.
You wrote last week about how Michael Brown's death had exposed tension in St. Louis. So there was unrest brewing before his death. When you heard about the shooting of Michael Brown, did you kind of go, oh, this is expected, now it's happening?
Well, you know, I've been covering St. Louis area government and the people now for St. Louis Public Radio and for other publications for a few years now. And I've spent a lot of time in North St. Louis County and the other parts of St. Louis County, which are, I would classify as more well off than North St. Louis County. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there is a discernible difference, I think, between some areas of the St. Louis area and others. I want to emphasize that there are some parts of North St. Louis County that are prosperous and stable, and North St. Louis County, where Ferguson is, has two of the biggest companies in the world located there, Emerson Electric and Express Scripts. So it's not all necessarily, you know, an economically degraded place, but there are pockets there where I think there's been a history of poverty. There's been a history of people having an antagonistic relationship with the police. I think that there's just general governmental fragmentation, which has kind of made things frustrating for the residents there. So when this thing happened on Saturday, not this past Saturday, but the Saturday before,
right.
I don't know if my reaction was, oh, you know, this is kind of the pot bubbling over, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But as it got larger and larger and larger, and some of these deeper issues that have maybe been discussed, you know, occasionally or in the background in St. Louis, they're now being discussed internationally and nationally. So I don't know if it's hard to say whether that's positive or negative for the St. Louis area. It might be good for us to talk about these longstanding issues. That the point of that piece, though, I was questioning whether after all the national media are gone, you know, is anything going to change? And it's going to probably take months, if not years, to really find that out, in my view.
The lack of information has been a problem. Is this just a small police department suddenly under a lot of pressure? Or what is your sense about that?
It's not necessarily that, because I think the Ferguson Police Department's authority here has kind of been gradually taken away by other entities, whether it be the St. Louis County Police Department, which is the police department that kind of covers most of the unincorporated parts of St. Louis County, mm-hmm. or even after St. Louis County, the Highway Patrol.
Right.
It's just a situation where when you talk with the officials that are kind of in charge of gathering information for these dual investigations, they mentioned these investigations take a lot of time. They have to talk to a lot of people. They have to gather a lot of evidence. And then after they do all that, they have to kind of put their heads together and come to investigatory conclusions. And especially with a situation like this, where there seems to just be a lot of different things that could lead to different outcomes as far as legal action,
mm-hmm.
I don't think people who are leading the investigation want to rush and try to do something before all the information is in. They've emphasized that multiple times, and I think that's just frustrating to the people that are out there that want some sort of action against this officer.
What has happened? I mean, what about the fact that they have now released the name of Darren Wilson is the officer. Has that had any impact on at least the daytime discussions?
I think that there was some angst for a while that Darren Wilson's name was not revealed. I think that people saw it at its core as a basic governmental accountability issue. You know, a police officer ended up killing a young man. Whether it was justified or not, I think will come, you know, to fruition from this investigation. But a lot of people who I've talked to feel out and out that it was not justified. And, you know, I think that not telling the name of the officer, especially when a lot of the names and the identities of looters were identified, I think many people saw that as a double standard. And I think that since the name has been released, I don't really think that caused any like particular angst amongst the protesters. I think what did cause a lot of consternation was at the same time that they released the name, they also released this security footage of Michael Brown and Dorian Johnson at this convenience store, and also this incident report about how he might have been involved in a strong-armed robbery. When I was at that press conference, and the people that were there who were not like media people, that were just protesters, that were just people who were watching, were incensed because they felt like doing that was just trying to disparage Brown and somehow justify this entire situation. I mean, that was kind of what they conveyed to the swarm of media there, and I think that caused more angst than releasing the name.
Captain Ron Johnson of the Missouri Highway Patrol was brought in to work on that tension a few days ago. Did that help?
I think Captain Johnson, who I think was probably an unknown before this, I mean, his stature throughout this entire situation, I mean, has just gone off the charts. And I think that the best evidence of that is there was a rally at Greater Grace Church in Ferguson on Sunday, and the headliners were, you know, luminaries like Al Sharpton and Martin Luther King III. But Ron Johnson made basically a surprise appearance. He made this incredibly emotional speech with no notes that caused the building to almost literally shake. And I think with that type of thing, he is providing kind of the moral leadership to both people within the community and outside the community. But that sort of thing is kind of combined with the fact that he also has to control this very volatile situation. And you could hear the frustration in his voice last night that, you know, things aren't stabilizing to the point to where he wants. When officers are getting shot at, Molotov cocktails and guns are getting fired, you know, 31 people getting arrested. So I think that his stature has definitely become a big part of the story. But the question is, can the stature lead to peace on the ground? And that's going to be an ongoing thing to watch in the next few days.
And finally, I mean, one of the problems has been that the police force in Ferguson is, I think there's 58 personnel, three of them are African-American, way out of whack with the community they serve.
Yeah, that has been an issue, and many of our reporters have talked about that at length. I think that just might, if there's probably going to be a lot of public policy blowback that comes out of that, but I think it might prompt some of these municipal police forces to maybe look at a situation like this and try to more actively recruit people in the police force that reflect their community better. You know, because that we've heard stories that some of the other municipal police force have similar issues, and the Attorney General has talked about a racial profiling in this area being a problem. So I would not be surprised if there was a intense push to try to rectify that, not only in Ferguson, but elsewhere in the St. Louis area.
Well, Jason Rosenbaum, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Jason Rosenbaum, he's a reporter for the St. Louis Public Radio. Coming up, more conversation about what's behind the militarization and the racial politics of police presence in situations like this. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The police shooting death of 18-year-old Michael Brown on August 9th has turned the streets of Ferguson, Missouri, into a battleground, setting off more than a week's worth of unrest in the St. Louis suburb. Captain Ron Johnson of the Missouri Highway Patrol over the weekend addressed a rally to call for justice for Michael Brown. Johnson was brought in to help ease the tension, to put a different face on law enforcement, not just a black face, but an empathetic face. Several times, Johnson made the point that he identifies with the community.
Because when this is over, I'm going to go in my son's room, my black son. Who wears his pants sagging, wears his hat cocked to the side, got tattoos on his arms, but that's my baby.
Violence has persisted, however, in the evenings ever since. And yesterday, the governor called in the National Guard to take over. Joining us now is Sharon Davies. She's director of the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State University. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. It's nice to be here.
We just heard from Captain Ronald Johnson of the Missouri State Highway Patrol. He was sent in to help quell some of the unrest. Part of the problem there and in many places is that the police force is predominantly white, yet it serves a predominantly African-American community. It seems like they can't correct this problem. I know they've been working at it in Columbus. It's a big problem. How does this play into it, this dichotomy?
It's really important, and it's important that we take it seriously because we just have not achieved the level of diversity within our police forces across the nation that would reflect the demographics of the communities that police forces are charged to protect and serve. And that's a major problem, and we haven't done enough about it in this kind of civil unrest in Ferguson really shows us the importance of that. It has been a gift to Ferguson that they chose to bring Captain Ron Johnson into the community, and he has done some good. One person, of course, can't do it all. And what we really need to be is far more systematic about our efforts to diversify our police forces, and not just our police forces, but all of our workforces, so that we see members of the black community in particular see themselves reflected in all of the institutions that exist across the country.
Listening to Captain Johnson, it's an emotional thing. This guy, if he was driving down the street, he would have seen maybe his son walking in the middle of a road, being a little scofflaw, being a little how they are. But the white officer saw something much different.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me a little bit about conversations that I had with so many white friends, actually, after the killing of Trayvon Martin.
In Florida.
Yeah, and black parents were expressing that they had a different set of fears about their black sons when they walked out of the doors every day, and that they had to have conversations with their sons about how strangers to them would perceive them in threatening ways, and that they had to tailor their conduct and behavior as a result of the unfair sort of assumptions that other people would make about them. And that was a reality for black parents that surprised a lot of white parents when they heard about those kinds of conversations in the wake of the Trayvon Martin killing. So now here we are again with another teenager who is dead instead of on his way to college. And so Ron Johnson can appreciate this both from the challenges that he experiences as a police official who has responsibility for keeping calm in the community, but also as a black man and a black parent of a son. So it is important that we hear voices from the Black community that can help white Americans really understand the reality of their daily lives and the threats against their children.
What do you know about this challenge of getting more diversity on police forces and fire forces, for that matter?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a challenge, set of challenges that are set, that are shared across occupations, really. And it all starts from very early ages when we begin to see forces pushing Black children out of school systems instead of supporting them through graduation, supporting their education. Black children are disproportionately attending failing schools, living in neighborhoods that have some of the most severe disadvantage surrounding them in their daily lives. And none of that is a prescription for Black success. And so until we begin to really see the connections between the lives of Black people starting from birth, then and the outcomes in Black lives later on, we won't be able to achieve the levels of diversity within our workplaces that we really want.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Sharon Davies. She's director of the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State University. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Judy in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I'm an African-American mother, brand new grandma, and you know, we're very upset about what happened to Master Brown. You know, when my son, we only had one child, my husband and I, a boy, when our son was 5 years old, we had to start teaching him what to do when you are stopped by the police. My son wasn't a thug. He's a nice young man. We sent him to private schools, you know, from middle school and high school, and sent him to college. He's a professional chef. When the police chief was interviewed, they said, well, did the shooter cop know that Master Brown purportedly had robbed a convenience store of cigars? And the police chief said no. So I'm saying that to say this child was murdered 6 times. That's an execution. I don't care what you call it. It's an execution. He was executed for walking in the street. We got a big problem with that. See, then white people cannot understand why Black people are so incensed, and they, pardon me, we protest. Some of them are looting. We don't, pardon me, we don't uphold that. But frustration, not just from what recently happened in St. Louis, it's all across the country. Mm-hmm. I'm a Black activist. I was working with Deputy Director George Speaks, Safety Director Brown, the Chief of Police, mm-hmm. about the same thing right here in Columbus, Ohio. And it was in reference to, I was very incensed when I see the new police recruits. Very few of them are Black. So I started working with them to encourage them and show them the necessity of having more minority. Listen.
Lady Judy, let me ask you, why do you think there's a hard time recruiting minority candidates for police?
Okay, let's just stay focused in Columbus, Ohio, because
right.
that's where I'm living right now.
Yes, all
Number one, what type of efforts have been extended to the Black community? See, everybody does not learn at the same pace. Mm-hmm. You know, even when you have the SAT, you know, for college. Mm-hmm. Number one, it's written by white people. And that's not a racist, you know, indication, because it's true. Mm-hmm. So you have to reach out to the people where they are in the manner in which they learn the best.
Okay.
I have an IQ of 130-something, but I'm probably the most illiterate person, not illiterate,
I doubt that.
Person in my, out of all of my siblings are very, very, very smart if it's predicated on the IQ. So you can't treat everybody the same. Deputy Director George Speaks, let me address some of the new recruits. And it was not surprising to me when you recruit these kids, and they're kids, come on, anybody under 25 is a kid to me.
Right.
They had a lot of them had no interaction with black people.
Okay.
Before they got recruited to the police department. Now, that's going to carry over.
Judy, we're running out of time.
I'm sorry.
No, you don't have to apologize. I just wanted to get Sharon Davies' take on the issues you're bringing up, and I do appreciate your call.
Yeah, so I think part of the obstacle is that we are also living in an age where the Supreme Court of the nation has made it more difficult in some ways to focus on diversity goals through its decisions in, for example, affirmative action cases. That is a part of a colorblind ideology almost that is very persuasive to a lot of folks, that we shouldn't really focus on race and not when we're making decisions about who to bring into our workplaces, who to admit into our colleges and universities. And without looking at race, it's difficult to achieve the kind of diverse levels of within these institutions and workplaces that we are talking about. And so there is a potent narrative out there that suggests that, well, it doesn't matter what race a police officer or anybody or any other worker should be. It should just be a person who is of quality and integrity. And it is true that quality and integrity are important, but lived experiences and understanding that are a part of an African-American's upbringing will be a valuable contribution that person can bring into a workplace, including a police force. So one of the problems is the result of court decisions that make it even more difficult to focus on this.
Okay, joining us now by phone is University of Missouri criminologist David Klinger. Welcome to the show, David.
Thanks for having me.
We've been hearing from witnesses that right off the bat, the officer in this case was aggressive. I've gone over scenarios in my head several times. How are street cops trained to deal with scofflaws like this, teenagers, especially teenagers who want to walk in the middle of the road, that sort of a thing? What do we know about that initial response and how it was handled?
I don't think we know very much. Part of the problem is that we've let rumor and innuendo and playing telephone, he said, she said, and then someone goes and talks to a news reporter and it gets out and then the rumor runs through the community. We really don't know how the encounter started. Now, part of that is because the chief of Ferguson has not acquitted himself with distinction in terms of getting the information out. But getting back to the preface of your question or the prefatory statement to your question, this issue of how are police officers trained, what police officers are trained to do is if people are violating whatever law, jaywalking in this case or, a traffic stop if someone runs a red light, is to make contact with the individual, ask them to do whatever it is that they need them to do, get out of the street, driver's license, registration, whatever, in a polite yet firm manner so that the person understands that they have to comply, assuming it's a lawful detention. And then if the individual refuses to comply, then the officer can escalate up. Unfortunately, sometimes police officers don't use the appropriate approach. Sometimes they come on too strong. I have no idea if that's the case in this case because we don't have any official statements. We don't have, witness statements that have been vetted by detectives and so on and so forth.
If I see a little old lady walking down the middle of the street, I'm going to behave differently than I would if I see a 45-year-old man carrying a gun versus
Absolutely.
A teenager walking down the street, and particularly in broad daylight, are officers, are police trained to deal with different people differently, like we would ordinarily?
Absolutely. And, and so an 85-year-old woman walking down the middle of the street, the immediate script that should be going off in an officer's mind is perhaps this individual is disoriented because police officers are trained about, you know, senile dementia, Alzheimer's, so on and so forth. If you see somebody walking down the street, a 45-year-old man with a gun, you darn well better not think, oh, maybe he's disoriented and just wandering around and I need to have a medical assist. In that circumstance, what you're going to do is you're going to call for backup immediately, notify dispatch of the situation, and you're going to get out of your squad car at whatever distance is appropriate based upon the circumstance with your firearm drawn. And the initial confrontation is not going to be, excuse me, sir, could I have a word with you? It's going to be stop, don't move, and then depending on where the person's carrying the gun, drop the gun, put your hands up, whatever the case might be, and hold the individual there at gunpoint, essentially, until the backup arrives. You mentioned a third scenario where there's a couple of teenagers walking down the street. Who knows? But basically, it's going to be somewhat in, somewhere in between the first two scenarios where the officer would once again politely say, please, you know, get up here, or maybe not please, but give them some command with the appropriate courtesy and then move on from there.
Well, you know,
Sheriff Davies.
One of the reports, at least from Ferguson, is that this particular officer wasn't especially polite in his first encounter with the two teenagers in that street. You're right. We don't have confirmation yet, and the community is certainly looking for more information about what actually happened. There are witnesses.
And ma'am, that's the absolute key. You know, I'm here on the ground watching my community burn, and part of the reason it's burning is because people are running with supposition based upon statements that have not been verified. And instead of working from, well, I heard this, that maybe he was impolite, we should say, here's one possible scenario. Mm-hmm. Let's wait till we get all the information. Instead of running into the streets, instead of creating protests that are legitimate, which then turn into burning and looting and attacks on both innocent citizens and police officers, this has got to stop. And one of the ways that we stop it is by telling people, quit accepting as gospel rumors. Let's slow down. Let's wait. If it turns out that there's a cover-up, if it turns out that the police are not doing the right thing, I will be the first person to call them out on it. But until we have evidence of that, until we know what happened, we need to slow down and take a deep breath.
Joining us,
simply don't know what happened.
Joining us by phone, criminologist David Klinger from the University of Missouri in St. Louis. Also with us, Sharon Davies, director of the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at OSU. We're talking, of course, about the violence, the reaction to the shooting of an 18-year-old boy in a suburb of St. Louis, Missouri. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The police shooting death of 18-year-old Michael Brown on August 9th has turned the streets of Ferguson, Missouri into a battleground at night, at least, setting off more than a week's worth of unrest in the St. Louis suburb. President Obama addressed the situation yesterday.
There's no excuse for excessive force by police or any action that denies people the right to protest peacefully. Ours is a nation of laws for the citizens who live under them, and for the citizens who enforce them.
This hour, we've been discussing police tactics in situations such as the one in Ferguson, Missouri. Everything from who they hire to be on the force to how that manifests on the street. Still with us in the studio, Sharon Davies, director of the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State University. And joining us by phone from the University of Missouri is criminologist David Klinger. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. David Klinger, I wanted to go back to what you were saying about how people just have to sit back, take a step back, wait until they have all the information before they act on it. We've heard that the police, if they had had a reservoir of goodwill in the community, they would not have had to resort to this military style of approach in the evening, right off the bat. How does a police force establish that reservoir?
I think the most important thing is to treat people with respect and dignity in every interaction. You start out that way. And then the other thing that I think people need to understand is that police officers, in my opinion, owe people an explanation for why they did what they did. So, for example, when I was a young police officer in Los Angeles, we stopped somebody because we believed they were involved in a robbery, a burglary, whatever the case might be, and it turns out they weren't. The worst thing that you can do in that situation is just say, okay, goodbye. And I've seen officers do that. What I was trained to do and what I would always do is say, sir, ma'am, here's why I stopped you. You match a description of this individual that we were looking for. I'm very sorry that we had to do it this way. Do you have any questions? And similarly, if a crowd had gathered, we would address the crowd. And invariably what would happen is one or two people in the crowd would say, yeah, the police officer did the right thing. He stopped Johnny because Johnny was, you know, he did look like this, that, the other thing. Even in situations where partners of mine and I have used force against people and there was a crowd, we then asked, does anyone have any question about what just happened? And if someone says, well, you just beat them down, then we would explain, and someone in the crowd would say, no, no, the officer's right. That's what happened. The person tried to punch the white officer. So I'm a white guy, and I was working with a black officer in one particular circumstance I'm thinking of. So that's how you do it. Each and every contact, treat people with respect and dignity, even if they're criminals.
So what is it that disincentivizes police officers from doing that?
I honestly don't know. You know, as I mentioned, I worked for the Los Angeles Police Department, and I think very, very deeply that a real sizable chunk of the problems that have gone on historically in my own agency is from officers who just don't get it. And I don't know if it's from the command on down. I don't know if it's squad by squad, but I have seen it work, and I have also seen it go the wrong way, where police officers are too busy. They think that they don't owe people an explanation, so on and so forth. And that is part of police culture that needs to be cracked and shifted away from that and towards treating people with respect and dignity, answering their questions. Now, for some officers, they might think it's an officer safety issue. They might think that they have to have a command presence to establish their authority. That is true. But once the situation has been taken care of, there's absolutely no reason not to talk to people about it. Unless, of course, people are encroaching in your space, threatening to take your prisoner, threatening to hurt you. But that doesn't happen very often.
Sharon Davies?
Yeah, so I think there are actually a number of things that are contributing to this lack of civility very often between police officers and the citizens that they are responsible for serving and protecting. A part of it is, unfortunately, as in Ferguson, that the police aren't actually members of the community that they are actually policing, and there to protect and serve. And so that's one aspect of it. Another is that the police don't very often pay close enough attention to their own data, which reflects over-policing of certain populations, in particular Black Americans. And so we've seen reports where it reveals that Blacks in Ferguson, and not just there, but across the country, quite frankly, are over-policed. They're overstopped. They're over-searched in rates that do not reflect the evidence that is obtained. And as a result of that, that contributes to this culture of mistrust between particularly young Black males and police forces across the country. And part of what's playing out, I think, in these encounters is unconscious bias. And this is an issue not just for police forces. It is an issue for all of us. Research, decades of research now show that a very big challenge for Americans is unconscious bias against Black people, and in particular Black males who are associated often unconsciously with criminality and with violence and aggression. And that is a part of the thinking that that plays out in the kind of example that you were giving a few minutes ago, and when you talked about a police officer seeing a young teenager in the street, and what he decides to do or think about that behavior by the young person could very well be impacted unwittingly, unknowingly, by those kinds of unconscious biases that we as a society have not yet really dealt with.
David Klinger, what about the idea of over-policing certain communities?
Well, I think that there's a big problem with a lot of that data, a lot of the studies that Ms. Davies is speaking about, and that is that it's not normed for two things. Number one is involvement in crime, and number two is the actual population of the location at the time that the officer is taking action, as opposed to the resident population. And so, for example, in downtown Manhattan, the population at noon looks very, very different from the population at midnight. And so if you're going to base, racial profiling stop data in Manhattan at the residences, you know, the people that live there, versus the population that the officers have to police the rest of the time, it's going to be skewed data. The other thing is you absolutely have to take into account involvement in criminal activity. And unfortunately, decades and decades of studies have demonstrated that the highest, the particular sociodemographic slice that is involved disproportionately in the highest levels of crime, young black males. And it's really tragic because the vast majority of the victims of black male crime are other blacks. And if you look, for example, at the homicide statistics anywhere in the country, basically, what you will see is that young black males are disproportionately involved as victims. They are murdered. And about 90% of young black males are killed by other young black males. That is an awful statistic, and that is something that police officers can't ignore. And so their job is to try to protect the innocents from the innocents from the predators. And that becomes a difficult proposition. And so where this issue of unconscious bias goes, Ms. Davies is absolutely correct that there's an awful lot of research on that, particularly about police use of force. But we've got some studies that are online, one that is going to be published in the Journal of Experimental Criminology, that suggests that there's a big difference between whatever might be going on unconsciously and the behavior that people engage in when they're presented with scenarios of different types of racial, ethnic opponents. So to make a long story short, I don't want to get too deep in the methodology. Participants are presented with scenarios involving white, Hispanic, and black suspects with guns, without guns, so on and so forth. And there's an indicator that there's a pop in terms of heart rate, so on and so forth, mental activity based upon race. They do look, the participants did look at race, but when it came to actually pulling the trigger, the patterns of behavior were not consistent with the unconscious bias hypothesis. And so there's an awful lot of work that we need to do as social scientists to get to the bottom of this.
I wanted to go back just a bit to the over-policing issue.
Yeah.
There's a big problem with heroin and pot and that kind of thing in upscale suburbs like Worthington, upscale mm-hmm. Columbus suburbs like Worthington, where I live. Mm-hmm. But an 18-year-old or a 17-year-old is much more likely to be arrested in another part of town on the south side or in less advantaged communities than they are in Worthington. That's been clear for a long time, hasn't it?
I know nothing about where the arrests are taking place. Are they in public space versus private space? My personal opinion is that the war on drugs has exacerbated the racial divide in our country because of that issue that you're talking about. And one of the ways that we address that structurally is call off the hounds regarding what I perceive to be a ridiculous attempt to control people's private choices.
Okay, in other words, drug use. Sharon Davies?
Yeah, so the problem with the statistics that David is pointing to is that those are outcomes of police discretionary decision-making. And part of the discretionary decision-making by police is who to police. And if you are over-policing a certain population and under-policing other populations, it will contribute to the arrest statistics, the conviction statistics that result from that. So that's one thing. But there is now irrefutable a neurological evidence that human beings do to react differently to perceived threats and fears when they are shown pictures, for example, of unfamiliar black faces. So there's a part of the brain that neuroscientists have been studying for some time. It's called the amygdala. It's the center of the brain that registers threats and responses to threats and fears. And these studies have shown that when individuals are shown pictures of snakes, for example, or spiders, that the amygdala really lights up. And that the same thing happens when they are shown pictures of unfamiliar black male faces. And this is a serious, serious set of challenges for us. There have been many, many studies that have shown, the shooter studies that David refers to, that have shown that even police participants in these studies who are trained in the use of firearms will have a tendency to make more mistakes when it comes to black possible threats to them than white possible threats to them. So in the shooter studies, these police officers have been shown to fire at images of black people who are holding innocent objects like a cell phone or a wallet, and to not discharge a weapon as quickly when faced with white images who are armed. And the same is true that they make mistakes on both sides in ways in which it will threaten their own safety out in the field, and will threaten black bodies when they're out in the field disproportionately.
David Klinger, we just have a few minutes left. I wanted to turn briefly to the issue of militarization and how police forces are garbing themselves and how they're arming themselves these days when something like the nighttime protests occurred after the shooting on August 9th. Mm-hmm. What do you make of that? And does that contribute to this immediate sense of overreaction by the force?
I have really mixed emotions because I don't know enough about the particular threat profile that the officers on the line are facing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like the image of police officers with rifles pointing them at crowds. However, I also am aware that there have been gunshots fired by members of certain crowds that have been there in Ferguson. I think the posture of having a rescue vehicle and armored personnel carrier, whatever you want to call it, doesn't look good. I think one of the problems on the ground here is that the local police have done a miserable job of explaining to the public why they're doing what they're doing. So, for example, when you see the skirmish line with these officers from head to toe in some type of armament, somebody needs to explain to people why they are wearing that. Someone needs to bring a police officer who's in this garb to a press conference and say, this helmet is on because X, Y, and Z. The shin guards are here because A, B, C, and explain to people. Whatever the case might be, however, in terms of what the police are doing and how they could do it better, nothing that the police are doing justifies rocks, bottles, bricks, coming at the police. None of it justifies going into a citizen's store and looting it. Mm-hmm. And that's an excuse. Oh, well, the police looked at me. They were wearing quote-unquote militaristic garb. Therefore, I'm going to break into someone's business and steal it. I mean, that's the height of lunacy for anyone to make that argument, and it's even more ridiculous if anyone buys it. Now, in terms of the dynamics of crowds and crowds moving mm-hmm. against the police, that's a different story where we can talk about how the officers might be doing things in a less provocative fashion. But once again, we need to know more detail. We need to know more context.
Sharon Davies, I only have about 20 seconds.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we have been here before. We have studied in rioting and looting that is in response to these kinds of police-citizen tensions in years past, decades past, and we just haven't learned the lessons yet that we need to learn from it.
Sharon Davies, director of the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at OSU. Also, David Klinger, a criminologist at the University of Missouri in St. Louis. Thanks to both of you. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.